Old junk isn't junk to everyone. To some, it's collectible or even an American treasure. I'm Jonathan Aul. Today on Talk of Iowa, we'll talk to two people who have built careers at looking at other people's junk and figuring out what it's really worth. On the first half of the program, we speak with Marsha Bemko, executive producer of the public television show Antiques Roadshow. The program is coming to Des Moines in August. We'll have a preview and talk about what happens when the Roadshow takes its show on the road. And in the second half, Mike Wolf of the History Channel program American Pickers will join us. He and his business partner work out of LeClaire, Iowa, and travel the country looking for junk that's worth money to others. Old stuff and its value today on Talk of Iowa. First, this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. Maybe you have an antique that plays an important part in your home, or something in the attic that's been passed down for generations, or maybe something rusting out in the shed. Well, it turns out some of these old items can be worth a fair amount of money, and taking those items in to have them looked at or selling them to somebody has captured the imagination of two television shows. Both of them have a connection coming up to Iowa, and we'll talk about them on today's program. In the second half of the program, we will talk to Mike Wolf of the show American Pickers on the History Channel. He's from LeClaire, Iowa, and we'll talk to him about his show and his art of driving around the country looking for people's junk that's actually worth a lot of money. But first, on this half of the program, we're going to talk about Antiques Roadshow, the public television program that can be seen locally on Iowa Public Television Monday nights at 7, usually repeated Thursdays at 7 as well. Antiques Roadshow is coming to Des Moines in August to the Hy-Vee Hall. And joining us now is Marsha Bemko, the executive producer of the show. She joins us on the line from Boston. Marsha, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for joining us. I think most of our listeners have seen Antiques Roadshow. It's certainly become one of the more popular shows on public television. And the general gist is that people bring their stuff and have it appraised. Why do you think that's captured the imagination of Americans and become as popular as it has?
The great part about Roadshow is that I think it appeals to different people at different levels. We have about 10 million viewers a week, so we have a very sizable audience across all ages. I think there are those who come who just want to learn something about that next antique, and because learning about great antiques are one of a kind. They're not mass-produced, so you learn about them one at a kind. Then it's a smart reality television show, so we can't help but learn something about ourselves and our country as these objects have stories to tell. And so they tell private stories, stories that relate to all of us, and we're all learning from the show. And I think we all just like watching other people have great surprise and great disappointment as well. So I think on all those levels and many others, we're lucky that way.
It's only a fraction of the people that actually have their items appraised make the show, obviously. It seems like the ones that do make the final program are people who have very deep personal attachments to these items. Do you think their motivation is the money or just learning more about it? Why do you think people come with these items to the road shows?
I know for a fact their motivation isn't money. Their motivation is curiosity. And our advice when people are coming to the show is bring something you're curious about. Don't bring something you can easily search for on the internet. How do I know this? Because I wanted to make a television show about what people did with their objects after they left Antiques Roadshow. And we followed up with many of our guests and discovered that they went home and put them back on the wall or back on the mantle, no matter what the value. And I can tell you there are exceptions to that rule, and I can tell you some stories where people have parted with their items. But the one thing that people out there who are selling their objects become quite aware of quite right away, and that is a fair price for a dealer to pay you is about half of what he can sell it for, and you're going to pay a seller's premium when you auction it off. There's always a cost to sell, and once you sell your object, you can't afford to buy it back. And I think people realize that, and they treasure this, especially things that have come down in the family.
Well, and those family connections, obviously for some people on the show, they talk about, you know, a vase that was on, you know, grandma's mantle and then it ended up in their possession. Or they talk about some heirloom that had passed down for generations. It also seems, though, the other next popular thing that happens is someone who just kind of happens upon something and, you know, they clean out their parents' house after they pass away and they find this thing and they didn't know anything about it. Do you think they have less of a connection to it when it ends up kind of being something that's a found item to them?
I do, and I think that when folks are lucky enough, and by the way, it's like stumbling across an unscratched lottery ticket. Keep in mind, when we're doing a roadshow event, we see 5,000 to 6,000 people with two objects each, and in half the cities we visit, we don't see a six-figure object, always a five-figure object. So truly rare is truly rare. So the odds are that is not going to, not something that is motivating people to come in. People are really curious, and they're never going to part with it. And I'm sorry, I lost track of what your question was.
Well, that's okay. So have I. I'm also curious about, because sometimes the appraisers will ask something about, you know, what level of documentation that may exist with an item. You know, obviously with a lot of these heirlooms, there's various stories about it on where it might have been or whether it might have been in the possession of somebody famous at some point. When they talk about documentation, what actually do they mean?
They're really talking about the provenance of an object. If you own an harmonica that was played by a famous musician, you better have some good documentation that proves it wasn't, frankly, my harmonica. Nobody wants my harmonica, but everybody wants one that was played by Elvis. So, Marilyn Monroe, her dress versus anybody, you know, a person without that kind of celebrity. And you need to be able to prove that. So documentation is one way of doing it. And then if you don't have the documentation, very often research can reveal documentation. But that's why we tell people, even when you're buying objects today, save your sales receipts. That's part of documentation. And so it's anything that can help you prove the provenance of the piece, prove the origins of and where the piece is supposed to come from, back that up.
So what other things might say exist as documentation? A sales receipt, a letter, I don't know, certificates of authenticity mean anything?
No, they're not known. COAs, as they're called, are not known to be something that we should rely upon because even they can be faked and often are. But let me give you an example of we had an Elvis outfit on our show that the guest had brought in. She had bought it from the estate some years before. And it was appraised for anywhere between $15,000 and $100,000. It was reportedly worn on his comeback tour. Now, this guest asked the audience, or the roadshow audience, geez, does anybody have a picture of him in this outfit on his comeback tour? They haven't sent it in to us. So if anybody has it exists, she still has something. If there's something out there that could help her prove this was the one worn on that comeback tour, huge financial difference for that item. So that kind of thing depends on the item. It always depends. But there's one example of documentation that may exist that you don't have.
You must have hundreds of stories of what it's like to work with people and to help fill in the information about some item that they have. Do you have any favorites that really stick out in your mind?
You know, it's like asking a mother to pick her favorite child who was good that day. There are so many good ones in there. I do have some favorites. My favorite moment from last season was when we were in Madison and Simeon Lippman told a guest about the Frank Sinatra letter she had brought in. And she had bought this. Mike Royko was the receiver of the letter that Frank wrote. And it's a very colorful appraisal where we learn a lot about what was happening in the city of Chicago at the time, especially from Frank Sinatra and Mike Royko's point of view. And the guest is just delighted to learn it. And so I think it's the guest connection to the objects that really help us. Jaded folks here at Roadshow who see thousands of things come through and watch how that story affects them and affects the rest of us that make an object stand out. And frankly, that letter is very colorful. Anybody wants to watch it, they can watch it on the website by looking up Simeon Lippman in Madison.
Any stories of people who are extraordinarily disappointed? I imagine you see people at their highs and some pretty big lows when they realize they don't have what they thought they had.
I think one of the ones that sticks out for me in more recent years, because they happen all the time, is when we were in Spokane and a woman had brought in what she thought was a ruby necklace. And I won't drag the whole story out, but another one that's worth watching her find out that it's glass worth about, I forget whether we said $10 or $50. She was hoping for $10,000 and was convinced. Were we sure? We had actually put it on a gem tester, and we were certain it was glass. But, and frankly, she's a good sport, but she was deeply disappointed.
I imagine that with these items that have been passed down through generations, when you hear the story repeated hundreds of times from your trusted family members, it's very painful to hear a professional appraiser say, no, actually, that's a reproduction, or it's not what you thought it was.
Yeah, I think that very often people who come in who think that something's been in their family for 100 or 200 years longer than it has are surprised to hear that, in fact, the item that was supposed to have been in the family since the 1700s wasn't produced until, circa 1900. And who knows, on camera, they you can see their disappointment. They clearly, but they're also puzzled. And very often we tell them something about the object that may help them figure it out when they have a conversation with their wider family. This is actually not from Boston, it's from Connecticut, and therefore was it people who moved and bought it then. And sometimes, even though there's disappointment in there, there's little tidbits that can help them get some other kind of satisfaction. And that's figure out the mystery of the piece.
Well, and you mentioned if the motivation isn't money but is curiosity, do a certain number of them, even though there might not be a financial piece attached to it, they walk away with a better understanding of what this thing is, and they can better inform their heirs when they pass it down?
And yes, and that's the big difference of what Roadshow does, frankly, different than any other television show out there on any other network. We give pure information. We don't buy. We don't sell. There's no influence there about anything being affected. It's just pure information for you to take. We provide a place in our event guide for you to jot down notes so that you can take that home, because that is part of the object's provenance now. The object has been to Roadshow. The object has a story to tell. Even if it didn't make it to tape, it's still that object's adventures, that object's story, it's part of that story.
Yeah, going to Roadshows would be part of its story now.
It surely is, and that's why it's a great, reliable way. And anybody, by the way, who wants to sell an object, the best advice I can give them: understand what you own before you decide to do that.
We're talking to Marcia Bemko. She's the executive producer of Antiques Roadshow that's coming to Des Moines in August. We'll have more with her in just a moment here on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. We're talking about antiques and old things this hour. Right now we're talking to Marcia Bemko. She is the executive producer of Antiques Roadshow, the public television program. They're coming to Des Moines in August. If you have a question for Marcia about the show, you can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or call 866-780-9100. Please don't call describing some object you have, because obviously we couldn't do anything like that over the radio. But if you have a question about the program or about Marcia's experience, go ahead and call or send us an email. Marcia, right before the break, you mentioned talking about other shows on television that do similar kinds of things but do it in a different way. Antiques Roadshow has been around for a while, and later this hour we're going to talk to some people from American Pickers. Pawn Stars on the History Channel is become a very popular show. There are other programs that have kind of followed this lead and do something somewhat similar. Is there any any anger or anything that you know, we had this great idea and you kind of stole it. Do you feel that about any of these other shows?
No, you know what, frankly, and Mike Wolf is a friend of mine from American Pickers. I like him very much. And I'm a big fan of Pawn Stars. I love the show. That being said, I would take issue with the fact that the only similarity between Antiques Roadshow and those shows are that we talk about things that people owned. And our show is really different in the fact that because there is no buying and selling, we make sure that you understand what you own before you sell it. Whereas on these other shows, they may not understand what you own before they buy it. And in fact, in that instance, you may be underpaid for the item because no one understood what was owned before it was sold. And usually anybody coming to an Antiques Roadshow event is not coming into the door with the motivation in mind that they're going to sell it. They know they can't. When you walk into Rich Harrison's shop, you're going in there to sell something with the idea of selling something or pawning it, either way. And the same thing with Mike Wolf visits your farm or wherever you live. He's coming with the idea of walking through your barn, your house, your yard, whatever it is, with the idea of buying things from you that you don't want anymore. And that the only similarity between them is that we talk about objects, and we do give history of objects when we talk about them. But the approach makes the information, it's a different approach on the information, and therefore, I do see them as different shows. What I'm glad those shows do is they get people excited about old things, and I enjoy watching them too. But if you don't understand the world of antiques, you could be hurt by selling things you don't understand what you own.
Now, Antiques Roadshow is coming to Des Moines in August. Now, the ticket deadline has passed. People who can go already know because they were chosen to get tickets, and you have to have a ticket to enter the event. But, Marcia, can you just tell us, what are these, when you go out on the road, what are these days like? What does it look like? What happens at these tapings?
Well, for those of us working them, they're long, that's for sure. But they're very exciting days. The day starts. We ticket the event, and anybody who's coming to our Des Moines show knows that they registered for tickets. And by the way, when people feel bad about not getting tickets, you should know that the enthusiasm for our Des Moines show was over 19,000 applicants for the 3,000 pairs of tickets we give out to the public. So most of Des Moines who wanted to come to the show couldn't come. But that being said, for those people who did get tickets, they're going to come with their two objects for each ticket. You can bring two items. And you're first going to come to the show and enter an area we call triage, but there's no blood. It's just an area where we have our experts sitting who will tell you whether your object goes to jewelry, it's obvious, but does it go to decorative art or folk arts or what area it should go to. And once you go to that area, you're going to talk with the expert who will tell you everything he or she knows about the object, unless, of course, we're interested in taping it. But the common experience most people will get is they'll walk up and find out that their porcelain vase is circa whatever, 1915. It's worth $100, and it was used to hold salad, and it was made wherever it was made, and do you have any other questions? And that's a very typical experience. But if we're interested in taping you, the appraiser will say, I'm not going to tell you anything about this. I'd like to talk with a producer. Will you wait? And that's for those people that you see on Roadshow. They are, in fact, learning their information for the first time on tape, and they don't learn anything prior to us taping the segment. And now hopefully, at the end of the day, everybody walks out filled with information, having had a good time, because the energy in the room is a great day. People are excited to be there. One of our appraisers, so I always quote him, Raphael Ellidge, who does Militaria for us. And as he said, people tend to pick the two items that after they save their family, if the house were on fire, that they'd save. So people are coming in with things that are dear to them. And you can feel the energy in the room. People are really excited to meet our experts and find out what they know.
The appraisers you bring in, great experts at a lot of different topics. Does anybody ever bring in anything that kind of stumps all of them, that hits one of those little tiny crevices in between their areas of expertise?
Occasionally we are stumped. So with 10 to 12,000 objects, I think we're probably stumped once or twice in a city. But the the best thing we can do is usually the expert will call somebody that they mm-hmm. and with everything we have these days, they can shoot a picture over and say, do you know? Because they'll know someone in the business who does know. But if, in fact, they couldn't reach a friend of that day, they will often be able to tell somebody where to go to get the information that we couldn't supply.
So when you go to, like, the Des Moines show, approximately how many of the people that come to that event will end up getting taped?
Out of the 5,000 to 6,000 people who show up, because everybody we gave a ticket to won't show up, which is a good thing. We plan on a little attrition there. About 90 segments will be taped between the multiple camera tapings and the single camera tapings. And, of course, that doesn't include the feedback booth or a web camera or all the other ways that people get captured at our events. But it is about 90. So, you can do the math. You can see it is a small proportion of the items that we see that actually make it to tape.
Now, of the segments that you end up airing, do all of the Des Moines ones end up on one show, or do they get sprinkled out among several episodes?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. We're going to make three delicious episodes from this city, and we'd make more if there were more hours in the day. you can be sure that in a place like Des Moines, we will have no lack of good things to talk about. We'll be discerning as we make our picks, having done this show for many, many years now, we're going to have a good show in Des Moines. You can tell just by the ticket demand, frankly.
Is there an approximate air date of when these would air?
Sometime after we start airing this season that we shoot in the summer, in the first Monday in January. Sometime mm-hmm. after that, and most likely before May. But I can't be any more exact like that because we really don't know. We do figure that out in September. And the best way to find that out ASAP is you can go to our website through your website. But you can go to pbs.org/antiques, and you can register for our fanfare newsletter, which we put that information out the day we get it. But also in October, you can check there, September, October, as soon as that broadcast schedule is ready, we post it there as well. So whether you want to register for the newsletter or just look for the posting, within a day or two of knowing it, we put it up because we know everybody's waiting to find out. People have parties.
I imagine Iowa Public Television will also be making a pretty big deal about it when those episodes air.
I'm going to guess that Iowa Public Television might have a party. Yeah,
or two or three or four.
Yeah.
So is it how difficult is it? Because I imagine that you may tape 90, but there may be 150 or 300 that are worth taping at some level, but you have to make the cut somewhere. How difficult is it to leave some of those stories on the cutting room floor, so to speak?
It is hard. What happens during the event day is I do what's called the picks, and that is selecting what's for tape. And I do that with two other people who are working with me because otherwise you'd wait hours for me to get there. You're listening to stories as you walk around. And some of them are obvious. Some of them, frankly, your two-year-old kid would pick because it's just so great anybody would pick it. It's all the other decisions, and frankly, the obvious picks aren't obvious. There aren't that many of them. We those of us who are doing it have been with the show for a while, so you can be sure if you bring us a Tiffany butterfly lamp, we're not going to talk about it, because anybody who's watched the show has seen us do that a couple of times. So part of it is, what have we talked about before? Does the object have a story to tell? And frankly, does the guest have something to learn? We like it when a guest has something to learn. They don't have to know nothing. Knowing nothing is not the answer when we come over there, because knowledgeable collectors are our favorite types.
Marcia, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much for your time. Antiques Roadshow is coming to Des Moines. You can watch Antiques Roadshow Monday nights at 7 on Iowa Public Television. Thank you, Marcia.
Thank you.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. This hour, we're talking about old stuff. And it might be worth some money. In the first half, we talked about Antiques Roadshow. A lot of the items that go to that program are Family heirlooms, things that sit proudly on mantelpieces and in homes across America. Well, another way of old stuff finding its value is when a picker comes along. And on this half of the program, we're going to talk with Mike Wolf. He's on the program American Pickers on the History Channel. They go to the barns, sheds, garages, and basements of America looking for that old stuff that might be worth some money. And Mike joins us on the line now. Mike, welcome to Talk of Iowa. Do we have Mike? We do not. We're working on that right now. We'll definitely look to see if we can get him on the line here. The program is American Pickers. It's on the History Channel. Season 2 of the program begins this evening. It airs at 8 o'clock Central Time locally on Monday nights. There's also a repeat on Wednesday nights at 9 Central on the History Channel. American Pickers on the History Channel. Mike Wolf and his partner Frank Fritz work out of LeClaire, Iowa at Antique Archaeology, and they go across America looking for a various assortment of old items that that might have some value to some people. And we're still trying to get Mike on the line. Mike, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, there you are. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hey, how are you? I'm sorry I had a little bit of a difficulty getting on.
No problem. No problem at all. So, American Pickers season 2 starts tonight. You and your business partner have been doing this for a number of years. How did this all turn into a television show?
Great question. It's been a heck of a ride. About 5 years ago, I started filming myself when I was on the road digging in barns, and the premise of that was I wanted to be able to tell the people stories that I come across, and I wanted to actually be able to give some of these items that I find a voice, because everybody knows on the back end of when you find something and you find a collectible, you're always wondering, you know, where it came from and how it came about. Well, all these things were unfolding in front of me, so I wanted to document it, and I started posting these videos on my website with the help of a local production company called Crazy Eyes Productions in Davenport. They were editing my stuff and posting them on my site. And then once those videos were on my site, antiquearchaeology.com, then a lot of people started taking notice of them, and everybody seemed to like them. So we started making more of them, and then eventually Cineflix, the company that produces the show right now, saw the piece, and they came and filmed Frank and I in upstate New York for 3 days. And once they actually showed that piece to History, then History, you know, just jumped on it and bought it. And we were really happy that it ended up there, because there was a lot of other networks looking at it. And I always thought that, you know, if it ended up on History, they would do the best job of telling the story.
So do you feel that at some level you're a historian?
Oh, completely. I mean, I've always felt like that. I mean, I've always felt like, you know, I mean, as a picker, you know, I mean, basically what we're doing is we're resurrecting a lot of things. I mean, we're rescuing things that have been sitting away in a barn and decaying, you know, a lot of the stuff that's actually sitting outside, you know. I mean, if no one gets to it in the next maybe 10 to 15 years, then it's just going to go away. A lot of stuff's disappearing from the landscape of America, and so we're taking these things and we're bringing them to market so people can actually enjoy them, they can restore them, and you know, that they can live on past all of us.
When in watching the show, it seems like, at least the stuff that makes air, the number one issue that you run up against are people who have all this stuff but aren't ready yet to sell it. Is that the number one problem you encounter when you go on these trips?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say probably, you know, maybe the numbers can be as high as 70% of the stuff that we find we cannot buy, you know. I mean, that's what's there. It's been sitting there forever because, I mean, it actually becomes, you know, it becomes part of their family. I mean, it becomes a part of who you are. I think that, you know, collecting is a very passionate thing, and once you reach that point in your life where you've collected so many things and you remember where you got them and how you got them and how much work you put into getting them, you know, then, you know, you just don't want to give it up. I mean, there's a lot of people that call us and say, hey, I'm at the point where I need to sell something. But when we get there, the actual reality of it starts sinking into them, and they're like, I don't know if I want to do that or not. So, yeah, that's always been a struggle as a picker.
Now, when in watching the show, you know, a lot of people, when they think about collectors, they probably have an image of, you know, display cases and tables with white doilies and various setups like that. The people that you interact with are people that have a lot of stuff in a barn or in a shed or in an area behind a barn or a shed. Do you think they're different kind of collectors, or, you know, someone might say, to what extent do they value this stuff if it's some of it just kind of sitting around in a big pile?
Yeah, I think that anybody that collects, no matter how they display it, if they collect something, and, you know, they might have a ton of stuff out in their yard, but, you know, I mean, that's actually their way of displaying it. And when you look at somebody that collects, and if they do display it in any shape or form, you're talking about a proud person. You're talking about somebody that is proud of what they have, regardless of what it is and how they display it. You know, we're running into problems now. There's a lot of ordinances in effect where, you know, people have to start cleaning some of this stuff up, a lot of these old junkyards and things. And I can understand that completely, you know, as a property owner myself. But, you know, get to some point where maybe we need to, you know, band together and put some fences up or something. So, you know, if you don't want to look at it, don't. But the thing is, you know, a lot of this stuff's not junk. It's national treasure. I mean, you know, we're a society of, you know, we don't manufacture anything anymore hardly. So a lot of these things are going on the wayside. I mean, I really believe there should be kids going from, you know, field trips to junkyards, looking at stuff that used to be, looking at the process of what happened to it, and having somebody explain to them, you know, that these things used to be made in America, and these times are not so long ago. I mean, you're talking 40, 50 years ago for some of this stuff that we're looking at. It's really not that long ago. It's just a blink of an eye, but, you know, all of it's fading fast, and it's scary to think that, you know, it's going to be gone someday. So it's cool to be in our position to where we have a voice now. You know, we're kind of the conduit to let people know, hey, these places still exist. These people are out there that, you know, that are collecting things. And when they collect something, then, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, it's the way I look at it is like, there's not a lot of things you can do in your life that you can put your fingerprint on and you can say, you know, hey, this is going to last forever. So when you see these big piles of junk and stuff, and some of it's valuable and some of it's not, but since that person saw value in that item, now it lives on. And if I find it, then it lives on again, and that's the beauty of it all.
Do you have I know it might be asking an impossible question, but do you have a favorite pick or a favorite recent pick?
You know, on the show, my favorite pick on first season was the gentleman that lived underground in Pennsylvania. I mean, he was incredible. He was, to me, he was like an artist. I mean, the guy was, he had a great eye as far as the things that he bought, the things that he collected. He did an unusual job of displaying them. They were 24 feet underground, but he the guy's willpower. I mean, the guy, you know, dug everything out by hand, and he started digging a hole in 1968, and he continues to this day to do it. And a lot of the rooms, I mean, you know, with obviously the editing of television and the amount of time we have, but a lot of the rooms, he just had beautiful things, you know. I mean, he was into transportation stuff. He was into advertising stuff. He was into some old boys. I mean, he was almost an artist, you know. When you pick something, it's like, you know, that's your palette, you know, things that you find valuable, you know, you're displaying them. And that's what I like about what we do is, you know, say you got like 10 pickers in a barn. You know, we're all going to come out with 10 different things. So it's really kind of an expression of yourself.
These people that you go and visit, they're characters, that's for sure. And some people may think that they're unusual or strange or weird, but you don't see it that way, at least the way you interact with them.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this forever, you know, since I was a little kid, and I mean, professionally for about 20 years, and nothing surprises me anymore. But no, I mean, I think that our relationship with them is that we like what they have. You know, these are people that have been told, hey, you know, you're weird, you know, you've been collecting this stuff, what are you going to do with it? Maybe even their spouses or their kids, you know, they just don't get it, they don't understand it. But when we come by, I mean, they see our appreciation for it. You know, sometimes they see that our eyes light up and they're like, you know, we're like, oh my God, I've got to have this. Well, then obviously that's maybe at the point that they don't want to sell it. But for us to have that connection, you know, you can be the big Harley dude and you're the tough guy in the neighborhood, but if somebody comes up and says, hey, you know, I really like your bike, that's awesome. Well, then all of a sudden you have that connection with that person, you know, so it kind of rolls that way.
So some of it is them getting some validation of sorts that the stuff that others see as junk, but they see as value. There are these two guys from LeClaire, Iowa, that also see value in it.
Yeah, you know, for me, there's always been, you know, I always had this thing, you know, there's no such thing as a nobody. And some of these people, I mean, they're kind of, you know, they're kind of introverted. I mean, they surround themselves with their collection, but when you look at their collection and everything they've done, they've kind of created their own little world. So for us to get in that and to enjoy it with them for a short amount of time, I mean, it's really an honor.
You know, there's certainly dozens of reality shows where people's lives end up on film in some level, their personal or professional lives. I've always just wondered, has doing this show fundamentally changed the way that you guys do business? Is it ever feel like it's more hassle than it might be worth at times?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, when I first started pitching this show, I had no idea what I was getting involved with. You know, I mean, it takes us 12 days to make 44 minutes. You know, it's a lot of back and forth, you know, with the camera crew and everything. But at the end of the day, I'm a small businessman and I'm a collector myself. So, I mean, I just go about my business and do my thing. I mean, Frank and I have known each other since eighth grade. So really, I mean, we're just completely being ourselves. You know, we don't have to act like someone else. As far as like digging deeper into my personal life, you know, I have an executive producer title on the show, and I also have a creator title on the show that I fought for. And so I do have, you know, what the say in the edits and stuff. I don't want to turn the show into, you know, hey, somebody throwing a wrench across the room and people yelling at each other and stuff. We have a lot of families that watch the show. We have a lot of kids that absolutely love the show, and I don't want to turn it into a circus.
So, what has this show meant to your notoriety in LeClaire? Not a very big town. Has this brought more attention to the town? Has anything changed in living in small town Iowa?
Yeah, a lot has changed. I mean, a lot of people knew me in town because I served on the city council here, and I was involved with the tourism board for a long time. But yeah, I mean, it's changed. Like over the weekend, we had what they called Pickers Day. LeClaire put together an event for the show, and we had about, you know, they're saying towards 15,000 people were here. You know, the pizza place sold out of pizzas, the caramel corn place sold out. I mean, it's great to see that, you know, people are coming to our community and embracing it and looking at it, you know, because the city has chose to go down the path of tourism. But, you know, as far as things changing for me, I'm pretty level-headed. I mean, I realize, you know, this is a gig. Maybe we've got it for about 4 years, and the people that came to visit us here over the weekend and everybody that watches the show, those are the people, you know, that's why I'm doing it. I mean, the ratings have been insane for this project. I mean, they've surpassed everyone's thoughts at history and my own, so we're just happy to be riding that wave.
So coming up in Season 2, which premieres tonight at 8 Central on History, what states did you go to that ended up being in Season 2?
Season 2, we're actually still filming, and we're filming that until February 11th.
Oh, okay.
Year. Yeah, so far in the last 2 months of filming, we've been in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Kansas, Missouri, Southern Illinois, Indiana. We've been all over the place, and this show tonight it was filmed in North Carolina, and it's got some great characters. We found some neat stuff, and now, you know, Season 2 is going to be a little bit easier for us as far as pictures go because, you know, with the notoriety of Season 1, we're getting inundated with calls and emails. I mean, literally tens of thousands of them that people are like, hey, I want you to come pick our barn or my friend's barn. So, you know, the leads are coming in, and that's, you know, good for us for business.
In the age of the internet, I'm wondering what role you play in this because, you know, if someone wanted to get rid of some of these things, if they wanted to sell it, if they were motivated by money, you'd think that the technology would be at a point where having somebody come in and take a look wouldn't be quite as necessary as it used to be. So what role do you play that technology can't play?
Basically, I mean, we're there. You know, the thing is, it's like me, for example, I'm extremely busy now, and I don't have stuff to put stuff on. I don't have the time to put stuff on the Internet like I used to. And a lot of people aren't Internet savvy. And to be honest with you, a lot of people don't want to mess with this stuff. You know, I mean, there's probably 80% junk in a barn, and then there's maybe 20% of what actually, you know, is valuable. The thing is, when you have general line antiques, like you might have an old dresser, you might have an old crock, or you might have a butter churn or something like that. I mean, that's common stuff. You know, sometimes you can go through an auction. A lot of the auction companies are really busy now because of the economy being so bad. You know, one friend of mine that owns an auction company, he's like, hey, he goes, I'm booked for a year every weekend. He goes, I don't even have time to take another auction on. You know, you can also go the route of an estate sale. A lot of people don't want tons and tons, hundreds of people trampling through their property. So, I mean, pickers have always been a good outlet. You know, we try to pay as much as we can. That's the thing, you know, it's like, say, you know, I buy something for $100 and it's worth $400. Well, I've got four employees here. I've got a mortgage. I've got a van. You know, I mean, realistically, out of that that $300 profit window that maybe we're maybe talking about, I'm maybe making $100.50. You know, so I think that's the hardest thing for people to understand is whether an antique dealer comes in, you know, and says, hey, I'm going to give you half of what this is worth. Sometimes it might end up to be, you know, a little bit more money on our side just because, you know, the cost of doing business is incredible. And that's the, you know, that's the one thing we share. So,
you know, the other show that is started on History almost the same time you did that is in the same general subject matter as Pawn Stars. I'm wondering, have you seen that show? Do you have any thoughts about it and how your show is different than it?
Yeah, actually, I've seen it quite a bit. I mean, those guys have been on the air for about 6 months more than us. So I was still in the process of pitching my show right when they came on. And, you know, I like the show. I think it's educational. It's a different way for people to look at collecting. You know, I always say that Frank and I are like the Flintstone vitamins of history. Kids are going to take it. They're going to like it. They're going to understand it that way. But, you know, anything that gets people looking at collecting and especially at a young age, because, you know, the thing is with us, like even my town here, you know, we've had two antique shops close in the last year. I mean, you know, the Internet's changed things. You know, we're not getting younger people involved. So, you know, both these shows do that. I think their show is a lot more manufactured than ours by far. I mean, we're going in a barn and we're going to see what we can find. I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, we don't know what's in there. We might get told sometimes, like, hey, this guy's got an old motorcycle or something, but, you know, it might be under, you know, 20 years of stuff. Good luck finding it. So, I mean, when they, you know, their show is shot in the same location, it's always at that same counter. You know, I think our show appeals to people more just because we're in a different location, we have different characters, you know, they're watching us dig through this stuff. We're kind of like the underdogs in effect, you know. You know, we're finding what we call the common man stuff, just like we are, you know. I mean, it's stuff that people can still find. You know, it's not an elitist show where, you know, it's like, hey, here's, you know, $150,000 Tiffany lamp, here's a Duesenberg car. I mean, these are things that people can relate to that we're finding.
You know, we Iowans like to think that, and we're often portrayed as being just exceptionally friendly, nice people, just the Midwest sensibility. As you travel across the country, do you think your Iowa-ness helps you? Do you think there's something innately in you, in addition to your personality, about that kind of Midwest Iowan that makes you approachable, especially to some of these people that might be a little more difficult to communicate with?
Yeah, I think when Frank and I go into, like, you know, major metropolitan areas, you know, if we're picking outside of Philadelphia or outside of Boston or, you know, Chicago or New York or where have you, you know, I mean, we have, the Midwesterners have a strong work ethic, man, you know, and it's like, you know, the time to make hay is when the sun's shining. So, I mean, we try to put our best foot forward. And I think that, you know, we're personable people and we're genuine. And that's one of the reasons that History liked the show. I mean, I didn't know if I told you, but this was the first time that History had ever bought a show without a pilot. You know, the proof of concept was there with all the videos that we had made, and they looked at Frank and I, and they're like, you know what, we're going to invest in this. We feel that these guys can carry this and do this. And, you know, for all of Iowa, this is a great thing because, you know, people see LeClaire, Iowa, obviously, but they see the state, you know, and I can't tell you how many tens of thousands of emails. I mean, literally, we've got over 8,000 emails in my inbox right now just in the last 4 or 5 days. It's people love to look at Iowa. They're like, oh my God, I had no idea Iowa was so beautiful. I want to come there, you know, or they moved away from here at such a young age and they're like, I'm so glad you're showing Iowa. You know, I just miss it so much. So it's a big pat on the back for everybody in this state.
Now, you obviously travel from coast to coast, but being based in Iowa, are there any more Iowa picks that might make the show, or have you been working here so long that you've picked pretty much what there is to pick?
I think there's always stuff to find on the back roads of Iowa. I mean, we're focusing on different areas now other than just the Midwest. Like, next week we take off to New Hampshire, and we just got back from Kentucky about a week ago. So, but yeah, no, there's a lot of great stuff. And to be honest with you, I mean, in the picking circles, you know, people I talk to in my industry, they come here from everywhere to pick our state, you know, and to look around. And so, no, you'll be seeing a lot more of Iowa in the Midwest, for sure, because, you know, we like to lose ourselves on the back roads, you know, and try to find those roadside relics. And Iowa's a great state to still do that.
Mike Wolf, along with Frank Fritz, is with American Pickers. It's a show on History Channel. The second season premieres tonight at 8 o'clock. It also reruns Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock Central. Mike is from LeClaire, Iowa. Mike, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck on your next pick.
Thank you for the opportunity.
This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Today's show, assistance from Lindsay Moon. We also had technical assistance from Christoph Mai and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about the program. You can contact us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us. ¶¶